This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another episode of our podcast. Help us grow our Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought by subscribing now at traditiononline.org, or gift a subscription to someone in your orbit who should be reading Tradition, perhaps a younger person in your life curious about the big ideas in Jewish life and learning. Eli Rubin's book, Kabbalah and the Rupture of Modernity, from Stanford University Press, presents a groundbreaking study of Chabad Hasidism. Through his close readings of primary texts, historical analysis, and engagement with modern philosophy, Rubin, a scholar and Chabad insider himself, traces the historical evolution of the movement's theology. The result is an indispensable work for anyone wanting to better understand Chabad's intellectual and historical trajectory. Todd Berman, author of a recent review of Rubin's book at traditiononline.org, conducted an in-depth interview with the author at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi. The discussion examined Rubin's argument that modernity, viewed from the Kabbalistic lens of tzimtzum and cosmic rupture, profoundly reshaped modern thought in addition to the inner intellectual life of Chabad Lubavitch and its spiritual vision. A key focus of their conversation was how Rubin's ideas speak to the challenges faced by young modern Orthodox students, and how mystical and existential thought can enrich their search for meaning, faith, and identity in the modern world. Rabbi Eli Rubin is a contributing editor at Chabad.org and the author of Kabbalah and the Rupture of Modernity, an Existential History of Chabad Hasidism. He received a PhD from University College London. Rabbi Todd Berman is the Director of Institutional Advancement at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi, where he teaches Jewish thought and halakha. The conversation was recorded live at Eretz HaTzvi in Jerusalem and contains questions from the young men in the audience.
One thing that I noticed in Jewish thought, if you teach Jewish thought, you see that going through the Rambam, all the way through the Rambam, from Gonim to the Rambam, you see kind of like a rationalistic direction. And then at a certain point in time in Jewish history, Kabbalah really took over. And you know, whatever period you want to see, it became a dominant view in Jewish thought. So I got very interested in that and started delving into that. And hopefully Dr. Rubin will help us kind of unpack how is that meaningful now with, you know, you guys from all walks of life, from modern Orthodox Jews or Jews who don't necessarily subscribe to Chabad Hasidut or any Hasidut or Kabbalah, what does this have to say to modern man? And this book, again, I highly recommend the book. One thing that's wonderful about Dr. Rubin's book, there are, I mean, many aspects. It's groundbreaking. It's fascinating in the impact of Kabbalah on Western thought, not Jewish thought, but Western thought in general, which we're going to delve into a little bit. But he has a real knack for taking complex ideas and as incredibly making them simplified and understandable when that's possible. A few times, it's really, really complex. You know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's a rumor Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a commentary to the Tanya. Have you heard this?
I never heard that one.
There's a rumor that he did and was planning to publish something at some point in time. But in any event,
Halach Man can be read as a commentary on Tanya.
Okay, well, you can explicate that more than I can. But one of the things interesting about Rabbi Soloveitchik in a few places where he's kind of critical about the mystical path and Kabbalah, which are not the same, he does mention the complex sophistication of Chabad and how to unpack that really requires a tremendous amount of thought and whatever. Dr. Rubin wrote, as I mentioned, he's also contributing editor of Chabad.org, which I think enables him to communicate on such a level. One thing, as you guys know, I'm not a Chabadnik, but one thing I really appreciate about what Chabad has done, and I don't know if that's really going to be touched on here, is the ability to communicate on multiple levels. Sophisticated, extremely high level Jewish thought, and to be able to communicate it to people who are not necessarily involved in philosophic questions, but they really can communicate that. And that way, Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous for his approach to Gemara. That way, I think Chabad did that wonderfully use of technology, etc. And Shabbat.org is an example of that, where Dr. Rubin is an editor. He received his PhD in Hebrew and Jewish Studies from University College London, UCL. His research on Chabad's intellectual and social history has appeared in leading academic journals, the AJS Review. Those of you who know Dr. Katchen, Dr. Katchen was the head of AJS for a number of years, like 10 or 15 years. That's the Association of Jewish Studies. It's kind of like the overarching umbrella group of Jewish academics in the world. Shofar, Ingeviv, I don't know where that is. And Jewish Currents, well, we won't talk about that, and the Lair House. Dr. Rubin stands at the unique intersection of Chabad Chassidut and rigorous academic scholarship, and we're excited to learn this dual perspective today. The first question, in fact, I'm going to open up with is, again, I love this book. If you didn't get that, I'm going to tell you, if you're interested in Kabbalah, you're interested in modern thought and philosophy, if you're interested in Chabad Chassidut, any of those things, which I'm interested in all those things, this book is really, it's critical. It's going to be one of those standard works that's going to be taught in universities, I think, in courses on Kabbalah. So you wrote, you're both come from a Chabad background, and you have went through the academic thing, which in the yeshiva world, not the Chabad world, you know, Chabad's funny in that it doesn't really fit into the categories people like to say, oh, modern Orthodox Judaism and Haredi Judaism. Is really also Chabad, which is totally independent. How do you navigate between those two things? What drew you to academia from a Chabad background? And if you could spell out maybe how is it meaningful to our students?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Roy Berman, for both a very generous review of the book in Tradition and a very generous introduction today. And good morning to all of you. Thank you for coming. So this question about how a Chabadnik ended up in academia is one that I've obviously been asked before, and I've given answers before, and I think that as time passes, a person comes to understand themselves better and learn new things about themselves. And so actually, as I was on my way here, I was thinking about this question in relation to the paper that I gave yesterday at the Yad Ben Tzvi Institute, and I came to a somewhat new understanding of how a Chabadnik would end up in academia and be attracted to academia. And as a preface to that, I want to say something about modern thought in general and what some scholars have called the secularization of theology, which happened. There's a scholar called Amos Funkenstein, an Israeli scholar who later taught in America. He wrote a book called Theology and the Scientific Imagination, about how at the beginning of the modern period, which for scholars, for historians of intellectual history, the modern period doesn't mean the 20th century. The modern period means anything from the end of the 16th century and forward. The different ways to think about what modernity is and how to define modernity, but as a general rule, we categorize the 17th century Descartes as one of the first modern thinkers. And so Amos Funkenstein has this idea that what was different about what Descartes and other people, Leibniz and other people, scientists, philosophers, were doing was that they were thinking about theology, about God, not as members of the clergy, not as rabbis, not as priests, but as regular people. And therefore, they couldn't rely on some kind of like mystical or religious authority to talk about God. They had to talk about God in a way that was coherent on its own terms. And this is what he calls the secularization of theology. Not that theology left God behind or left spirituality or the divine behind, but that theology became something that was secular in the sense that it could be spoken about by ordinary people without having to rely on some kind of special religious authority, you know, that I'm a pious person or that I have special insight because of, you know, my pedigree or because of my great learning. This is something that comes into the realm of coherence. And there's a special connection between this and Chabad. Chabad is also very much focused on coherence. Chabad is, as Rabbi Berman said at the beginning, on the one hand, Chabad is drawing from the Kabbalistic tradition, which is a mystical tradition, which you would assume kind of relies on this kind of spiritual authority, piety as the measure of theological authority. But Chabad is also integrating that with the rationalist Maimonidean perspective. And if you read the Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman Liadi, cites the Rambam a whole bunch of times at very crucial points to explain his idea of God's unity, of God's oneness, of singularity of all things, which is a very mystical idea. He uses the Rambam and the language that the Rambam provides, even though he's doing so in a way that the Rambam might not agree with or recognize, but he's appropriating the language, the coherence of the language and the philosophical arguments and principles of the Rambam, and he's marshaling them to give coherence and to make his theological ideas, his mystical theological ideas, more persuasive. So I think this is, for me, this is kind of one of the kind of meeting points between the academy, which is the heir to Descartes, to the secularization of theology, which, you know, all the great universities started as religious schools. They were all founded by monks, right? And in England, in the 17th century, to teach at Oxford or Cambridge, you had to be a member of the clergy. But in the universities, this process of secularization happened, where theology became science. You know, and Funkenstein says that in the 17th century, theology and science were identical. You know, but then things started to move away as a result of the secularization of theology. So then you could also throw out theology and just do science, just do secular thought, right? So I guess all this is to say that in the secular academy of which is the place of modern thought today, one of the things that define research, philosophy, the formulation of understanding is this kind of is a principle of coherence. We have disciplinary principles that we apply in clearly defined ways, how to do research, how to ask questions, how to read texts. There's a coherence that is at the bedrock, or that should be at the bedrock. Sometimes it gets, increasingly, maybe it gets mixed up with all kinds of theoretical jargon which evade coherence. But in principle, it's supposed to give you a set of coherent disciplinary tools that can help you analyze ideas, analyze history, analyze culture, analyze society in coherent terms. And Chabad is also providing a language of coherence. So in that sense, there's a certain natural coming together of these worlds, which happened for me, because I was somebody who in yeshiva craved coherence. When I first started studying Chabad texts, I had a sense that some of the teachers, the first teachers that I had, were not really explaining things coherently, but I had a belief, a trust, a faith, that the Chabad masters had something coherent to say, and that there was something philosophical that they were saying. And eventually I did have teachers who explained things philosophically and wanted you to understand the question before jumping to answers, which I think is also a crucial thing in the academy. Critique, questions, stand kind of in their own right. Before you get to an answer, you have to have a good question. You have to understand the question and not always jump to stop the question from being asked. The question is fruitful. And so I had a teacher like that. His name was Rav Melech Zwiebel, and I write a bit about him in the introduction. He was a chassid of... He grew up in Tel Aviv, actually, after the war. Learned in Lod, in the Chabad Yeshiva there. And then in the 60s, came to America and stayed. Came to America to study with the Rebbe at the Central Chabad Yeshiva in 770. And he became a mashpia. So he kind of set me... He opened, from within the Chabad Yeshiva system, he opened up a very coherent philosophical way of thinking about the theological ideas that are in Chabad texts. He also helped me to think about history. And from there, you know, there are a bunch of other things that happened along the way, but it kind of set me on a road that very naturally, seamlessly ended up in me writing a PhD.
Well, can you explain maybe just a little bit about your path, like okay. Where you studied and...
Yeah.
Sorry about that, we're being technical.
Okay, so I studied in the regular Chabad Yeshiva system.
In England.
First in England at the Yeshiva Manchester, then I came to Morristown, New Jersey, where I studied with Reb Meir Spiegel. And after that, I was for 2 years in Los Angeles as a shliach in the yeshiva there, which in Chabad yeshivas, when you get to the age of about 20, you finish the four classes, four shiurim of the standard yeshiva. If you succeed in your learning, you get sent as a bachur shliach to a yeshiva usually. Sometimes it's to a Chabad house to run learning programs, but usually it's to a yeshiva. And I was sent to the yeshiva in Los Angeles, Er HaChanan, Chabad, which was actually started by the son of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, and then taken over by Chabad. There's a yeshiva, Er HaChanan here in Yerushalayim, I believe, which Rabbi Simcha Wasserman established. But he first established an Er HaChanan in Los Angeles and then moved here. So that yeshiva became Yeshiva Er HaChanan Chabad. I studied there for 2 years.
Became a Chabad yeshiva?
Yeah.
Rabbi Simcha Wasserman yeshiva
became Chabad? Yeah, yes.
But he didn't.
No, he didn't. No. After he left Los Angeles, that yeshiva became a Chabad yeshiva, yeah. And it retained the name, Er HaChanan. Yeah. And then I learned Yerideya in Melbourne for a year. And at some point during that time, I started reading academic articles on Chabad, so still while I was in yeshiva. And I started a blog, actually while I was in Los Angeles, I started a blog. This was the era of the blogosphere, this like old ancient history. But there was this thing called the blogosphere, look it up, fascinating era. And I had a blog called Chabad Revisited, where I wrote about Chabad thought and history and commented on academic research on Chabad sometimes. So I was already kind of thinking about these kind of questions about how Chabad became what it is. I was interested in like how Chabad developed from the Alter Rebbe to like modern day Chabad. And I was kind of exploring some of those questions, and Chabad.org actually contacted me. It was an anonymous blog. I didn't put my name on there. And they said, you know, we're interested in what you're doing. And,
you know, we had a speaker in the yeshiva. What's his name? That's his research is to figure out who writes anonymous blogs.
So they said to me, you know, when you have a chance, we'd like to talk to you. So at that time, I think I was just finishing up in LA, and I was planning to go to Melbourne. So I told them, you know, I'm not planning to do any, you know, I'm planning to learn for at least another year. But when I come to New York, I'll let you know. And so after I finished in Melbourne, I came to learn in 770, but I planned to get a job at Chabad.org or at Kahas. I wanted to write, I wanted to do translation, I wanted to bring Hasidic ideas into coherent English. And I met with the people at Chabad.org, and they said, look, we see from your blog that you understand academia. We don't understand academia. We need someone who understands academia. We don't really know what we want you to do, but we want you to join our team. So that's how it started.
Was there any tension? Like, within the you know, the yeshiva world, they really, like, it's funny, you quoted Er HaChanan Wasserman, and when, you know, that development, someone who really did not like university approaches to anything.
Right.
Was there tension in Chabad with the academic university stuff?
I mean, there is, I would say, a suspicion in Chabad of academia. I never had that suspicion. I mean, it's good to be suspicious. I guess I have some of that suspicion, but I felt more generously spirited to it. I saw its value. I saw the value of the tools of academia for coherently conducting research with a set of tools of how to evaluate text, how to think about history, how to think about ideas. So yeah, till today, you know, people will talk to me with this kind of rhetoric of suspicion, and like, you know, do they really know anything? You know, and so on. But there's also, Chabad also has a kind of innate, I guess, an ethos of communication and an ethos of, right, Yefutzah Ma'anesach HaChotzah, of sharing Chabad thought. So from that perspective, they understand some of what I'm doing, even though I'm not only motivated by the mission of sharing Chabad ideas. They understand that part of it, at least. There is some of that tension there. And actually, when I was hired at Chabad Rog, they said, you know, we think that you should start by publishing some articles on Chabad Rog, which are engaging with academic research, like maybe some book reviews. But we don't know, like, what's kosher and what's not kosher. We have an internal review board, and we have an external rabbinic review board. They're going to have what to say. And, you know, you're going to have to fight with them. So this was like, you know, my first meeting when I was hired, when I was given the job. They were kind of saying to me, we want you to do this. We don't know exactly how to do it, but we'll work it out. You know, there is this tension, and I think it was seen as a healthy tension. And I also see it as a healthy tension because having to write for more than one audience really keeps you on your toes, right? I'm not writing only for Chabad people, and I'm not only writing for academics. I'm writing for both audiences, and I need to. I'm trying to be coherent, to be recognizable, to be legible to both of them. And also, when you're writing at Chabad Rog, you're not writing for Chabadniks or academics. You're writing for a much broader lay readership who might have very little knowledge. So that combination of thinking about different audiences has definitely helped me to, first of all, to make sure I'm authentically presenting the materials. I'm loyal. I'm engaging with the tradition of Chabad in a way that's respectful to the tradition, while also doing so in a critical way. So having that tension, I think, has been very helpful to me.
Maybe we'll jump into a couple pieces about the book itself. So you talk about Tzimtzum, and you talk about Tzimtzum as rupture and how the Arizal kind of impacted modern thought in general. Could you jump down, explain Tzimtzum real quickly, explain why you call it rupture, and how that kind of influenced modern philosophy?
Okay.
Maybe I'll explain a little bit more Tzimtzum.
What? That's what you said. Can you explain Tzimtzum?
Besides rupture, I'm saying before rupture.
Before rupture, yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So Tzimtzum is a very old idea. It originates in Midrash. We have the idea of Tzimtzum, that Tzimtzum HaKadosh Baruch Hu Eshchinasoi Bin Badei Ha'arim, that God contracted His Shechina, His indwelling, His presence, between the staves of the Aron and the Holy of Holies and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that's in the Midrash already. And so that's an idea of concentration, the concentration of God's holiness at a particular point. So God Himself, we would imagine to be, we would conventionally understand to be infinite, not to be located in any one place, to transcend any place, and perhaps to be beyond place at all, right? To be outside of existence, to transcend the world, and to be greater, be more. The fullness of God can never be contained in the universe. And yet, God concentrates Himself, simtzim et atzmo bein badei ha'aron, made Himself present in this place, in this finite place. So that is the original notion of Tzimtzum. And there's a debate about scholars about how much continuity there is between the old idea, let's say the Midrashic idea of Tzimtzum, and the Kabbalistic idea of Tzimtzum. Scholars like Bracha Sachs and Moshe Adel there's a lot of discussion on this. Moshe Del has a long article basically arguing that the Kabbalistic idea is nothing new, it just flows out of the old idea.
One of my teachers and I, right. That's my background.
Right. And there it becomes basically a kind of Neoplatonic idea about where the Neoplatonic vision of the world is that the world and all forms of existence just kind of flow out of God. God, the ideal of wisdom is in God, and we also have wisdom in the world. The ideal of kindness is in God, and there's kindness also in the world. And kindness isn't just kindness; it's also the paradigm of, let's say, sweetness, of bounty, of plentitude, right? So the aspects of the world that are giving, that provide us with sustenance, that comes from divine grace or kindness, and the aspects of existence that are more limited come from divine discipline, and that translates very neatly into the ten sefirot, right? So these are emanations of God which manifest themselves in reality in a kind of seamless flow from God to the world. And that kind of mirrors this idea of God being concentrated, flowing from his infinitude and manifesting himself in the world, in the Holy of Holies. But in the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, who we can call the founder of modern Kabbalah, that's, I think, scholars like Yonatan Garb would say that. Even Adele would probably agree with that, even though he would argue that the Arizal symptom is nothing new. But other scholars, who I tend to agree with more, like Yoni Garb, argue that the Arizal symptom is a different kind of symptom. The Arizal's idea of symptom is not one of God concentrating himself, revealing himself in the world, but rather God withdrawing himself. So symptom means contraction or concealment, withdrawal, rather than concentration and revelation in the world. It means a withdrawal or a concealment from the world. And this is the idea that because God is infinite, is too infinite to allow for anything else to exist, I like to ask my students to imagine an infinite table. Right? If you imagine an infinite table, so the table extends infinitely upwards, infinitely downwards, infinitely outwards, it has infinite legs, and there's no room for any other tables in this room. If this table is infinite, none of the other tables can exist. Okay? They're all going to get swept out of the way. And the same idea applies with God. If God is infinite, there's no room for anything else to exist. And so therefore, in order for the cosmos to come into being, in order for God to create the worlds, God has to remove his infinite radiance, has to stop asserting himself infinitely, withdraw that infinitude, and create a place where there's no empty of revelation, a metaphysical place perhaps, rather than an actual physical place, because we tend to think of these things in terms of dimension, in terms of space, but space itself is a construct, is a creation, something that God makes, as probably as mathematics or any dimension of existence we can assume is not fundamental, is contingent on God having decided that being should be in this manner. But setting that aside, God is removing himself and allowing there to be a space for other things. And this is the new modern idea of Tzimtzum. And what does it have to do with modernity? And what is it? Why do I think of this specifically as a modern concept? So this has to do with something that I was talking about before, the secularization of theology. The idea of distinguishing clearly between the world as it is, the cosmos as we experience it, the natural world, and God. Is an idea that really depends on Tzimtzum. So the possibility of thinking about secularization, about things that are not fundamentally mixed up with the divine in some vague mystical sense, depends on saying God is outside of the world. So before the Arizal, or let's say before Descartes, if you just have a Neoplatonistic worldview, so God is in everything, and everything is a function of the divine in some way, everything flows out of God. You can't really think about God as God. And you can't really define God as something outside the world, because you're thinking about the divine in terms of the world, right? Yeah, like, Plato has this idea of the cave and the shadows in the cave. So what do you know of God? You're looking at the shadows, and the shadows tell you there must be something beyond, but you don't really know what that is. So this Funkenstein also uses this term, vague hints, right? So theology is vague hints. It's something which is everywhere and nowhere, right? It's something that you can't really separate from superstition, from science, from just the world, right? But once you have the idea that God is outside of the world, and that the world is this new thing, which is totally separate from God. So then we can start thinking about, then the possibility of modernity emerges, the possibility of secularization emerges, the possibility of drawing a clear distinction between an enchanted world where everything is somehow divine, everything is somehow a reflection of the divine.
Wait, so does the non-Jewish world accept the Tzimtzum idea and its theology ever?
So part of my argument is, and I set this out in the book, is that I don't know if Descartes was influenced by the Arizal. I don't know if he knew about the Arizal. He's born about 20 years after the Arizal passed away. Lurianic ideas spread very quickly throughout Europe. They're translated into Latin very quickly. And what we do know is that the reception of Descartes amongst other thinkers, but even in his lifetime, is happening at the same time as the reception of Lurianic ideas by those same people. So I talk about two figures who are they're part of a circle called the Cambridge Platonists. These are philosophers, non-Jewish Christian philosophers in Cambridge, England. One of them is, his name was Henry Moore, and the other was Anne Conway. And Moore writes both about Tzimtzum, the Arizal's idea of Tzimtzum, and about Descartes, and he dislikes both ideas for the same reason. And that is because it opens the possibility of atheism. Once you can talk about the world without God, atheism becomes possible. Maybe the world is just material. Maybe there is no God. If God is outside of the world, and we can think about the world just as a world.
I seem to remember that once, I learned by Shlomo Rosenberg.
Okay.
Professor Rosenberg. I seem to remember that he said something like, that after the step after Tzimtzum is what all religions start arguing. What happens then?
Right.
Like the next step. So where is God after Tzimtzum? And what's religion to the world is where all theology, all religions start arguing about.
So that means he foresaw my book. He must have been a prophet as well as a professor.
He was, by the way.
Right. So yes, in short, yes. Beyond the Jewish world, there was an awareness of the new Kabbalistic ideas. And Anne Conway, who was a kind of student of Moore, wrote a book called The Principles of Ancient and Modern Philosophy, something like that, in which on the title page she says that she's going to use the philosophy of the ancient Hebrews, by which she actually means modern Kabbalah, right, the new Lurianic Kabbalah, but she thinks it's an ancient, it is in some ways ancient, right, because it's part of this long tradition of Kabbalah. And maybe she agrees with Adele, right? That it's an old idea, not a new idea. But she's going to use these ideas to answer the problems and the questions which can't be answered by the modern schools of philosophy. And she names Hobbes and Descartes and a couple of others, right? And so they all have problems, but with the ancient philosophy of the Hebrews, we can sort this all out. And she's probably the first person to write about Tzimtzum in English, and this is at the end of the 17th century. Wow. Yeah,
that was one of the coolest things in the book. I was like startled by the idea that it really impacted outside of Judaism. The next piece I have here, I might just, I'm going to jump a little bit. What do you think this theology has to offer to a good modern Orthodox student going to yeshiva in Israel?
Okay, so, well, first of all, I think by now it should be clear that you can't really think about God in the modern era without thinking about Tzimtzum. So anyone who wants to think about God in the 21st century has to reckon, I think, with this modern split between God and the world. And one of the things that I try and show in the book is the way the Chabad thinkers are responding to this rupture, right? This new way of thinking about Tzimtzum is they want to bring God back into the world, right? So they are not there's a whole debate about whether the Lurianic Tzimtzum should be understood in a literal way or in a more metaphorical way. I think that's way too simplistic. I don't have time to get into that now, why I think that's a too simplistic of a construction. But basically, what the Chabad thinkers are doing is they're using Tzimtzum, and they're confronting the possibility that God has been removed from the world, and they're arguing with a philosophical coherence, with a full understanding of the stakes of this question. They're arguing that God remains in the world, and that God is present in the world in a concealed manner, and yet it's, despite that concealment, is accessible, remains accessible to human beings. So Chabad is providing a way for modern people who are confronting this rupture, confronting the possibility of atheism, the possibility of secularization, the possibility of disenchantment, of a purely materialistic understanding of the world.
You say Chabad. Is that all Hasidut?
I would say specifically Chabad, because Chabad is engaging with this in these clear, philosophical, coherent terms that face up to the problem, as opposed to just ignoring the problem. I think there are some Hasidic groups who, they say, modernity has happened, and we're just going to continue as before, and we're not going to respond to modernity, we're just going to keep doing our thing.
On a philosophical level.
Yeah, on a philosophical level. Now, there is a kind of response to modernity.
They still believe in the same idea that Chabad does it, which Baruch Hu does it.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not a theological focus between Chabad and...
No, I mean, we can talk about... There are gradations. There are, you know, okay, there are many subtle distinctions to be drawn. But yes, of course, the general, beginning from the Baal Shem Tov and continuing through most Hasidic streams, you could, Breslov maybe is slightly different. We could talk about that separately. There is this understanding of God's presence in the world, of a saturation of everything with divinity. But what's specific to Chabad is this facing up to the question, and tackling it head on in a philosophical way, in a rigorous way, in a way that is not just saying, okay, there are some people who don't believe, we believe, right? We're going to have emunah, and we're going to carry on, and we're going to celebrate our Judaism, and we're going to celebrate the presence of God. Okay, people have questions, we don't have questions. Chabad is saying, no, these are serious questions. We want to think about these questions, and we are going to present serious answers. But first, before we get to the serious answers, we're going to take the question seriously. So therefore, this is why I think that Chabad is really essential for modern Jewish thought writ large. And I think if you look, you know, we mentioned before Rabbi Soloveitchik, but the same is with Rav Kook. Rav Kook drew heavily on Chabad sources, and so did Rabbi Soloveitchik. I think to a degree that is not yet properly recognized.
That's interesting, Rav Kook. I did this with some of the guys. Rav Kook actually has a letter where he talks about curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
He says, of course, you should learn all the Kabbalah of Chabad and the Grah and whatever, but he advocates that, you know, certainly Chabad, you know, all the Chabad masters, you should learn them and,
right,
and the Grah and whatever.
So he, Rav Kook had a secretary whose name was, I think, Shimon Glitzenstein, who was a Chabad chassid. And he himself, I think on his mother's side, came from a Chabad family. And Glitzenstein writes in a memoir that Rav Kook would constantly study Likutei Torah from Rabbi Shneizam Leviadi, which is the compendium of discourses, which was published by the Samach Tzedek. And that's a tremendously, on the one hand, it's Hasidic Torah, so it's, you know, it's following the Parsha, and it's giving you like a drash on the Parsha, and it's weaving in mystical ideas into the stories of what's going on in the Parsha, or the different mitzvahs that are in that week's Parsha, and so on. But it's also a tremendously philosophical work. It's a very well, these drashot are very philosophically developed, what in Chabad parlance is called Haskalah, and taking Kabbalistic ideas and articulating them in this kind of psychological, philosophical manner, which I think, and also in a poetic manner, right? There's a poetry in the discourses of Rabbi Shneizam Leviadi, which I think is reflected in the style of Rav Kook, in his poetic spiritual mysticism. I think that's one of the, not just in terms of the ideas, but also in terms of the poetic style, I think Rabbi Shneur Zalman Liadi, not so much the Tanya. The Tanya is also written in a highly literary mode, but not so, not I wouldn't say in a poetic mode. But the drashot in Torah and the Kutta Torah, there's a kind of poetics of the soul going on, and I think that that is reflected in Rav Kook. And with Rav Soloveitchik also, if you look at Halachic Man, for example, so most people read Halachic Man as a kind of critique of Hasidism. I read it as more like a commentary on the Tanya. If you look at the footnotes and you follow the footnotes closely, you'll see that the most cited works are Tanya and Likutei Torah. Okay, check it out. And very often when he argues, there's the religious man or the mystical man, and there's the man of halacha, and there's these two sides. But if you follow the footnotes, sometimes both sides are in the Tanya. He's drawing on Tanya for both sides of this. And so in my reading, he's not arguing for one side or the other. He's really presenting the interplay between the halachic man and the homo religiosus, because both are necessary ingredients to being a modern Jew, right? You need to be a man of science, a man of halacha, and have this mystical religious aspiration, and you need to kind of bring them together. And these are, they're conflicting, but they're also complementary. And I think if you follow the footnotes and you see how, you know, when he's setting up this kind of schism, both sides of the schism are actually sourced sometimes in the same Hasidic text, you see that maybe this isn't a schism after all. Maybe what he's kind of, it's a foil, right? It's a way of presenting the different parts of the self which need to be developed and then cohere together.
Rachel, yeah.
Here. Just one more thing on the dynamic you were describing about different groups that either try to find continuity in the past or recognize that there's a rupture. I think you can draw that same dynamic within modern Orthodoxy even, or in contemporary Orthodoxy, where even in the modern Orthodox world, there are those who would say what we're doing is not that different from what the Rambam was doing or Sajigon or any number of religious thinkers in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. So the idea of integrating contemporary science into the world, the idea of being open to the philosophical trends around the world, right? Contemporary modern Orthodoxy is really following exactly in a tradition from what came before. And there are others who would say, no, the questions nowadays are different. But contemporary modern Orthodoxy is very different from something that the Rambam would have recognized or a Jewish thinker in the 17th or 18th century would have recognized. And that dynamic feels very similar to the dynamic you're describing within Hasidus, where some would say that what we're doing is basically the exact same thing that we've always done. And Chabad, you're saying, recognizes that there's a difference and is trying to navigate the difference. Clearly, you're note, what resonates with you is the side that says things are different. And I want you to explore that a little bit more. What do we gain by saying the world is different as opposed to trying to keep doing what we've been doing until now?
Right. Yeah, well, I think you're right that these two, there's always continuity and difference, right? I don't think, and one of the things I trace in the book, actually, is within Chabad, the development, the historical development within Chabad, how in each generation there are these changes happening where the rebbes are articulating anew the ideas that they've received. So there's a tradition that they're part of, and yet, in each iteration of the tradition, there's something wholly new going on. So I don't think we can let go of either of the sides of this, again, the schism. I think it's too simplistic to say that it's either a complete rupture or just wholly continuous. But I do think that to ignore the difference is to risk becoming irrelevant, to risk becoming stale, to risk, you know, there's something that's just coming into my mind now, which is a teaching from the last rabbi of Chabad, I think it dates from the 1960s, it's a talk he gave on the last day of Pesach, and In Chabad, the last day of Pesach is associated with Mashiach, Mashiach Soda, right? So we have there's a kind of Fabrengan, which is held at the end of Pesach, which is in a way mirroring the Seder at the beginning, where we celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim, but instead of celebrating Yetzias Mitzrayim, we celebrate the Yetziah from the present Galus. And just like we drink four cups of wine at the Seder, we drink four cups of wine at the Mashiach Seder. So at the Mashiach Seder, I don't remember which year it was, the Rebbe begins with an idea which is kind of shocking, but it resonates with me in a very strong way. And he says that the reason why the Galus, the exile, has been so long is because without the expanse of time that has passed, we wouldn't have all this new Torah. Right, so in order for Torah to develop, to come to its fullness, you need innovation. Chiddush in Torah is an ideal, which is probably rooted actually in the Zohar, in the mystical tradition. This idea of that in every generation, every person has their portion, their new contribution that they need to make to the Torah. Now it's become an ideal in the yeshiva world, but I think it's really rooted in the Zohar. The Ksas, in his introduction, cites the Zohar as to advocate for this ethics of innovation in Torah. And so, like, what is the relevance of time, right? Why does time pass, right? If everything is supposed to stay the same, then why have time? Like, time should just, like, in other words, I think that time itself, and I think this is what the Rebbe is getting at in this comment about the necessity of exile, the necessity of the length of the exile, we need this this process of change, of difference, of moving on from the past to something new in order for Torah itself to be renewed and to be developed, to be added to be built out, to be extended and come to its fullness. Otherwise, we would have a very impoverished... The tradition itself would remain impoverished if the tradition didn't have the room, the expanse, to change and develop and renew itself.
Guys, any questions? Yeah.
Prefacing this with that I'm not personally a Mekubal, but the amount of literature that comes out coherently on Kabbalah seems to be disproportionately from those sort of outside of the world, those who take it personally seriously, if that makes sense. The likes of Gershom Sholem, etc., who might not incorporate Kabbalah into their own personal theology. Whereas you present and articulate very clearly and kind of rooted that in the Chabad tradition, Kabbalistic ideas, well and coherently. As someone outside of Chabad, I think it's very easy to get the feeling that the Hasidut has moved towards a much more emotionally based connection to God. And that's kind of the big thing that we see Chabad doing, is if that makes sense, as outsiders. And so I would ask, firstly, would you share that opinion? If so, why do you think Chabad has moved in that direction, and what can be done to bring it back to its roots?
That's an interesting question. First, I would say that there are coherent Kabbalistic texts out there beyond the world of Chabad. I would recommend the Pardes of Moshe Cordovero. It's a very clearly written sefer of Kabbalah where things are really... it's like an encyclopedia, you know, he maps out the different topics and explains them in a very orderly fashion, in a very clear, coherent fashion, and that's before the Arizal. Some scholars have categorized the Arizal also as a kind of scientist, a kind of encyclopedic, you know, Reb Chaim Vital's works are also kind of mapping out, although his texts are more complicated and more esoteric, it can be more difficult to figure out what he's actually saying, but I think even for a beginner, Ramak is crystal clear, I think.
I think more scholarly texts, right. Modern era rather than sort of source texts.
Right. As to the question about contemporary Chabad and like a turn towards a more emotional stance, I would say that there's...
I want to ask this question, something that really I question, is that kind of such a two different worlds that are sometimes so extreme that we see in Chabad, that seem to be as if how they come together. The Chabad of Kiruv, the Chabad of Thailand, and Chabad of this kind of and then the intellectual Chabad, the texts, the writing. It seems so the gap is just so enormous between these two sides of Chabad. I get confused myself.
Right. I understand the confusion, but I think what I would like to say is that Chabad's activism and like the public side of Chabad is very much powered by its intellectual core. So a Chabad shliach is somebody who sat in yeshiva and studied the Tanya, studied the Rashab, probably most of all the Rashab. The Rashab is at the center of the curriculum. We didn't really say anything about Rashab, but the Rashab, the fifth Rebbe of Chabad, is one of the most philosophically coherent of all the rabbis, and also one of the most philosophically innovative. And he founded the Chabad Yeshiva, and so what teenagers, guys your age in yeshiva, are studying for, you know, probably an hour and a half every day is the Rashab, and they're studying Samach Vav. They're studying deep theology, which kind of critiques the whole of Jewish thought and then rebuilds it from scratch. And they're not always, you know, they're young, they're teenagers, and they're not always fully cognizant of what the stakes are and what's going on. But they are very much in their blood, as it were, in their formation as young adults, is this very highly intellectual and highly engaged reckoning study of theology, right? Of the mystical theology of Chabad, and that theology has a lot of concepts that are familiar, probably to most people here. Concepts like Derech B'Tachtonim, which became like catchphrases, right? Like, you know, we have to reveal God in the world. Right? So these have become like very simple, let's say simplistic, like slogans, right? But when you study Rashab, these are not simplistic slogans. They are deeply argued out theologies. And it's precisely because they are deeply argued out theologies which are engaged with by young people, so they become identity forming. And that's expressed in this intense activism, right? So when you see the activism and you see the emotion and the excitement, the energy, that's powered by this formative intellectual engagement. And I just recommend in Joseph Bronstein's book, Engaging the Essence, he has a chapter which I think is called something like From Sinai to Mitzvah Tanks, where he head-on addresses this question of how do we get from the theology of Chabad to mitzvah tanks, right? And he tackles that in a more coherent way than I've just done. So go and read that.
Other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned Dylan about
his... louder, I can't hear
you. Sorry. You mentioned Dylan before about your friend doing a different scripture outside of the Chabad, but something doesn't make too much sense. What is the defining aspect?
Okay, so that's a good question. What distinguishes Chabad's Kabbalah from other schools of Kabbalah? So the first thing to say is, even before we get to Chassidut, there are debates amongst Kabbalists about how to interpret the Arizal, whether to interpret him, as I mentioned before, as understanding God to be totally outside of the cosmos or hidden within the cosmos. So that already makes, you know, has massive theological implications. The whole idea of Derech B'Tachtonim only makes sense if you have an immanent concept of God, that God is accessible within the world, that God is concealed with the world and waiting to be revealed. That's only possible if you go with that school of Kabbalistic thinking that says the Arizal should not be interpreted literally. So that's one distinguishing element of Chabad thought. But more specifically, Chabad is a Kabbalistic interpretation of and theorization of the Baal Shem Tov. So the Baal Shem Tov has a set of theological and not just theological, but you could say, psychological, spiritual messages, ideas that he wants to communicate, which you could articulate without Kabbalah. You know, it's an ethos. It's an ethos about, it's a spiritual ethos of oneness with God, of connecting to other people, of having a kind of emotional, joyous relationship with the world and with God, right? It's a principle of unity. I always like to cite the Baal Shem Tov's letter to Reb Gershon of Kitov, the famous letter where he says, when will Mashiach come? He asked Mashiach, but after that, he says, how will this happen? He's very worried, very concerned about how is it even possible for his teachings to be spread to the point that, as Mashiach says in his response, it will be spread out to the extent that everyone will be able to bring together unifications like you. So he's very distraught about how this could possibly be brought about. But then he says, there's one thing I can say, and he seems to be saying this as something which is accessible to everyone. He says, in everything that a person says, whether it's a word of Torah or prayer or in anything, even mundane speech, a person should recognize that there's God, souls, and worlds. So, and when you pronounce a word, when you speak to somebody else, you're bringing together God, worlds, and souls, right? So there's this kind of cosmic communion going on in the relationships between people, in communication between people. So that's a very kind of spiritual idea, which doesn't rely on any Kabbalistic theory. You don't need the 10 Sefirot for that or anything like this. But Chabad is taking that set of spiritual principles, ethical principles, and theorizing them through the theological structures of Kabbalah. So Chabad's Kabbalah is not just distinguished by its immanent idea of God, it's also distinguished by its very close relationship with the Hasidic ethos of the Baal Shem Tov. So it's, Martin Buber famously said that Hasidism is Kabbalah become ethos, but Chabad is the ethos of Hasidism become Kabbalah. The last part is my addition, right? He just said the part about Kabbalah become ethos.
If you were going to leave 18-year-old, 19-year-old students in a gap year program with like a message, so what would that message be? Like about, I don't know, theology, what they should be studying, whatever.
I think I want to say take the question seriously. I think that often in educational settings, especially religious education, there's a focus on the answers, having the right answers, and sometimes that can become like an apologetics, or it can be, if you have the answers without having worked for them, then the answers aren't really answers. I think the answers are only answers if the questions were questions. And so before jumping to the answer, give space for the question. Sit with the questions. Maybe that's something that can be dangerous, but I think it's also very important.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask, very idea, very new to the idea of Simpson. Which of the approaches do you think is more important for us to understand or to nurture? The idea of God as concentrating his presence or constricting it. Which do you think is more important to nurture?
I think both are necessary, because without the idea of God's transcendence, of God being removed from the world, so then you can end up with a very impoverished idea of God. You can end up with like a Spinozian God. You can end up with a God who is essentially just the universe, just material, just kind of the spiritual dimension of the world that we know. God as creator. There's a line that the Alter Rebbe says in the Kutei Torah, in Torah, the main thing about God is not that he created the world. And that's an idea that depends on this more extreme reading of Simpson as rupture, that actually when you think about God as being infinite, creating the world is impossible. So the main thing about God is not that he created the world. The main thing about God is something which we can't even begin to know. And that idea, the idea of God as being utterly transcendent, I think is very fundamental as a starting point for theology. But if you stop there, then you're just left with an inaccessible God. You're left with no theology, right? And so therefore, you need the idea of God being, of God concentrating himself within the world, revealing himself within the world. And Chabad is not actually only going with the Lurianic view. Chabad is actually taking the older idea of Tzimtzum and integrating it with the Lurianic idea of Tzimtzum. So Chabad is always, and Amos Funkerstein actually has a great article about this, where he argues that the Tzimtzum of the Ramak, which is a generation before the Arizal, which is really the old idea of Tzimtzum, the idea of Tzimtzum as a concentration of God, a revelation of God within the world, is found in Chabad and integrated with the Lurianic idea of God being wholly removed from the world, distinct from the world, withdrawn from the world. The two are being brought together, and I think it's integral to kind of create that marriage. Because without it, without the marriage of the two approaches, I think you end up at a dead end, one way or another.